when our marvelous pianist Pat Jones makes a trivial mistake like adding one line to a hymn, he embarrasses more charmingly than anyone I have ever known. But Pat, you need to be assured that there is one gentleman sitting out in the audience who loved that mistake. He believes that every verse of every hymn should be sung. And although we deeply love and respect each other, we will both go to our graves totally disagreed. I think that less is more. My philosophy of life is that you always leave an audience wanting more instead of hoping that there won't be another verse or another 5 minutes to the sermon. I believe in brevity for everything except my ministry in this church. Congregational churches, as most of you know, were born 350 years ago in protest against the control of church life by any single person or group other than the membership of the local congregation. Decisions about whether to call or dismiss a minister, about what stand to take on social, economic, or moral issues, these were not to be imposed by a bishop or from conference headquarters. The very first Congregationalists, whom you also know as Pilgrims and Puritans, turned their backs on most of the pomp and ceremony and special holy days of the medieval church, arguing that first century Christianity had not been interested in such things. And that is why in some congregational churches still, you won't find as much emphasis on Pentecost or Advent or Lent as some pulpits give them. But times change, and our religious neighbors do influence how we worship. So it was no great surprise to me to hear a prominent Congregationalist suggest recently that we might join other believers in giving up something addictive and seductive for Lent. And he had in mind one thing: television. Now, the reaction of one of our ministers who preaches in Chicago was probably typical. He wrote in his church newsletter that the idea struck him as unthinkable, unworkable, and possibly un-American. But he decided later that he might just try it. And since his family felt that he had lost whatever modest mental health he possessed, he made no effort to get them to join the program. And he confessed that it turned out to be much harder than he had thought. He had several bouts with what he called PTSD, post-television stress disorder, in which the victim stares glassy-eyed at anything shaped like a box. And he had a little trouble with PRK, which is Phantom Remote Control Kinesia, which involves an involuntary twitching of the thumb and forefinger of the right hand. He did not illustrate his Lenten sacrifice, but his wife did, inadvertently, when she sought comfort from some of her close friends. You'll never guess, Frida, what he's gone and done now. And as the news got around, some of his friends found it hard to start a conversation. They would begin with the words, "Did you happen to see on TV?" and then stop in mid-sentence as if they had just trespassed on a private grief. Some of the bolder ones, he said, looked at him as if he had shaved a map of Texas on his head and wondered aloud, "What on earth possessed you to do something like that?" So he tried to create a convincing list of reasons. That it was a good idea, for example, to prove he was not a slave to an industry capable of some good and considerable harm, believing, as he did, that television violence really does increase aggressive behavior in children, that it often encourages disrespect for parents and other authority figures, and that it teaches a vocabulary designed very often mainly to shock. He thought about the 5-year-old who burned his house down after watching those icons of the 90s, Beavis and Butthead, play with fire on TV, and some of the other copycat crimes he had read about. But as an adult, he told himself, he probably was not at risk for much more than electronic insomnia, which is that inability to fall asleep in bed after one has napped through most of the evening in a recliner with his hand on the remote. So harmfulness, at least for him, did not seem a sufficient reason for a Lenten sacrifice. So he tried a second reason. "It's because I need the time I would otherwise spend watching." He figured out that since the average person spends about 20 hours in front of the set each week, or some 1,000 hours in a year, giving it up for a while might let him finish a few projects he had let slip. But since he was prone to overwork anyway, and the television provided some needed relaxation, he had to admit that time saving was not his best reason either. As a minister, it bothered him that TV seemed to have taught people a shorter attention span than ever, and that truth, that most valuable commodity, instead of coming from carefully marshaled fact and clear logic, came mostly through powerful images that hit quickly, one after the other, exciting the nerves, but leaving no time for reflection. Dramatic stuff, spectacular, too slickly packaged to resemble much of anything in real life. He had seen how TV religion has affected church worship. The most successful churches now, in terms of audience size and budgets and buildings, are the ones that rival television for staging and drama. Worship as entertainment, with a band or an orchestra, with testimony from famous athletes, rock stars, country music singers, flags everywhere, often indoor tropical forests. In the big ones, I just toured the latest example in Oklahoma City with its 2 large waterfalls in the sanctuary, which might at least have the virtue of drowning out the sermon. So much shrubbery and so many trees inside that it was hard in some spots even to see the speaker, and with a pulpit soaring up about 20 feet out over the audience, as if the preacher were riding a boom camera high above the flock. The influence of television is everywhere in the mega churches of America. Giving it up for Lent, our man decided might be his personal way of saying, "You don't completely control my life or dictate the way I worship." But he may have missed something even more important. A young minister I know pretty well in Oklahoma City writes quite differently about television and its influence, not so much on the church as on home life. He is working on a book in his spare time which will be entitled Morning Sun on a White Piano. Colon, subtitle, Simple Pleasures and the Sacramental Life. It will be a series of chapters on returning to the lost worlds of talk and reading, of music and humor, of parenting by parents, instead of turning the kids over to the tube as babysitter, to handwritten notes and affection and creativity, all aimed, he tells me, at fast-moving, compulsive yuppies who have discovered that the new car smell is not enough, that daily life has to be more than just the interval between dream vacations. His first chapter about the lost art of conversation claims that the world is filled with noise but starved for meaningful discourse. The reason, he writes, is that television is the great social interrupter. It pulls faces away from each other and toward the monologue that is entertainment. The art of conversation started dying when we moved from the table to the couch. Passively, we listened to others talking, and there was no place for us to speak our lines. We laughed at other people being funny, cried when others were sad, and cheered our sports heroes as if we were playing. As the light of the tube flickered in the zombie faces of a whole generation, the sound of families being families, arguing, teasing, cajoling, encouraging, setting boundaries, investigating one another's feelings, and telling stories all faded to black. One more paragraph, because somebody taught this young man to write well. The extent of this silence in a world of racket is so far advanced that drastic measures are needed. Love cannot survive silence. Children cannot grow apart from the words that bridge their fears. And adults cannot rehearse and refine their relationships if they never hear the sound of their voice or the voice of those they care about caressing the moment. What a marvelous phrase. What then is the first move in the recovery of a sacramental life of simple pleasures? It is to cut the cord on the television set. He doesn't do it totally. That cultural ivy that drips its anxiety and its terror into the sanctity of your sacred space and keeps you drugged with impossible images of the unattainable life It is to say by action and not by sentiment alone that you refuse to let yourself be shown how to look, how to act, and what to wear. Only when the blue light of television fades will people get to know themselves again in the white light of morning. I tell this young minister that his book will sell, that Thoreau's Trinity for the Good Life now sounds more profound than ever. Simplify, simplify, simplify. People will buy your book, I tell him, because our pace is too fast. We drown in trivia. We want someone to tell us what matters. I'll bring copies up when he finishes the book. And finally, we come to the third item in this potpourri sermon, the one I have designated by the single word, Daddy. We had in this pulpit last Sunday a very personable young man who made some good points in a sermon about the parable of the prodigal son, but who really startled some of you, and let's be honest, offended some of you, by suggesting that we should think of God and pray to God as Daddy. Your reaction was so intense that I took it as an opportunity to say something about a trend in modern religion which sentimentalizes the idea of God. Our guest, who spent 2 days in my home and whom I both liked and respected very much, fresh out of seminary, explained to you that the Aramaic word Jesus used, on occasion apparently, the word Abba, A-B-B-A, is a more familiar title for a father than is suggested by the Greek word pater. And then this young man, influenced by seminary or some religious writer whose pen was filled with maple syrup, translated Abba by our contemporary English word Daddy. Quite a few of you flinched. Several of you wondered in comments to me later if that was really sound theology. Well, I won't try to keep anyone in suspense about how I feel. I would cringe every time I heard someone use that designation for God, even if I thought it could be theologically defended, and I don't think it can be. When Jesus says in the Garden of Gethsemane, Abba, Father, Abba, Pater, remove this cup from me, the Aramaic word for Father is followed and, in my opinion, simply translated by the Greek word Pater, Father. Biblical scholars do not translate this as Daddy, Father, remove this cup from me. The Apostle Paul says once that when we cry, Abba, Father, it is an expression of our belief that we really are the children of God. And J.B. Phillips, in his splendid translation of the New Testament, is right, I think, to show that these are just two words for Father. Not radically different from each other, one in Aramaic, the popular language of Palestine, the other in Greek, the language of a different culture. And in Mr. Phillips' version, the comment of the Apostle Paul goes like this: you have been adopted into the very family of God, And you can say with a full heart, Father, my Father. Now, it's true that the Aramaic word Abba is a familiar form, which servants were forbidden to use in speaking to the master of the house, although the children could do so. But to choose the English word daddy as a synonym is to belittle and diminish the majesty of God. Connotations of words, the emotional associations that cluster around them, can be even more compelling sometimes than their dictionary definitions. And daddy has too many connotations that just don't fit God. Dad may get a little bit closer to the Aramaic term, but even it suggests a buddy, a pal, a kind of cozy relationship I think Jesus would never have imagined between mortals and the God he worshiped. Jesus was a Jew, after all, and he had inherited that long tradition which spoke of God like this: His name is great and terrible. He is holy. He is mighty. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And there is that scripture. Mike read to you from the lectern a few minutes ago, the one from Isaiah, who saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, with the seraphim calling out ceaselessly one after the other, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of His glory. And how, as each one called out, the very threshold shook to its foundations, and the prophet trembled and cried out with fear, because he, an ordinary human being, had seen a vision of the transcendent and almighty God. Can you imagine Isaiah writing, I've just seen Daddy? It will pass, this brief popularity of the sweetly sentimental, this gentle Jesus, meek and mild, who is too nice to be let out of church and into the marketplace. And this God as Daddy, so condescendingly intimate and playful with His children that He will tolerate just about anything and can be manipulated by any smart child of His? No way that the Lord's Prayer will be changed to read, Our Daddy who is in heaven. And for a word from the New Testament, here is one. Listen, let us give thanks to God and so worship Him as He would be worshiped, with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Somehow those images are not called up by our domestic word, daddy. A just and demanding God, a God gracious and merciful at times, the eternal creative spirit behind all that is, nothing less than that will work for most of us. Want a blunt truth from an old guy who no longer feels much need to beat around the bush about it? Daddy is fatty. And it will pass. And just in case you're wondering, I would be delighted if our guest last Sunday were to accept an invitation to be youth minister in this church. Not only because he showed a great deal of promise, but think of the fun he and I could have on gray, rainy afternoons, talking about such things as whether it works to call God daddy. Thank you.